Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Much of the country is in the path of a major winter storm today that is icing over roads, closing airports, and causing rolling power outages for millions of Americans. Oklahoma City plunged to a record low 6 degrees below zero this morning. The last time it got even close to that cold was more than a century ago. Alana Rocha, a reporter at the Texas Tribune, woke up to an unfamiliar scene. Here she is with her 4-year-old daughter, Remy, and 17-month-old son, Patrick.
We are in Austin, Texas, and woke up this morning to see what outside, Rem?
Snow.
Yeah? Uh-huh. What do you want to do in it today?
I want to do snow angels and snow. I'm building snowmen.
Yeah, how beautiful is our backyard?
It looks good.
It may look good, it may look beautiful, but it's also dangerous. Joining us now is Mark Elliott, a meteorologist and storm specialist at the Weather Channel based in Atlanta. Mark, busy day. Thanks for making time for us.
Oh, absolutely. You're not kidding.
Yeah, and then first let's focus in on Texas, because we do not hear about snow and cold like that very often. How unprecedented have the conditions been in Texas?
I mean, by all measures, this is just an incredible weather pattern that led to some incredible weather that's really not done yet. I mean, as an example, you were just hearing from that family in the Austin area. They're going to have single-digit low temperatures when they wake up tomorrow morning, which has only happened 8 times in the long recorded history of the Austin area. I mean, this is an impressive cold air outbreak by all measures, and to see the snow across Texas, very impressive as well. San Antonio officially had 6 inches of snow from this storm.
Wow. Well, this has been going on for a few days, because there was recently that terrible pileup around Fort Worth where 9 people died, and it now looks like every county in Texas is under a state of emergency, and we're seeing millions of people there who don't have power because of the burden on the power grid. It's just so great. So how dangerous is a storm like this?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit underappreciated how stressed the body can get over when underneath these extreme cold conditions. You have to take all kinds of precautions. I mean, everyone was saying, you know, don't go traveling unless you absolutely have to. And I think most people are listening to that. But, you know, have blankets in the trunk of your car in case you do get stuck somewhere. Know where those extra blankets are in your house in case you're, you know, you lose power for an extended period of time. It is not a comfortable thing to go through. We'll put it that way.
Right. And when wind chills are that low in a place like Texas where it doesn't happen very often, it might be worth it for people to know, like, what does it feel like and how dangerous, how long can you be exposed to that kind of weather?
You know, in single-digit temperatures, like we are forecasting into central, even portions of southern Texas, along with wind chills that will be even colder than that, I mean, you can get frostbite outside in a matter of minutes. So, yes, it's fun, right? You heard the kid. There's a fun side to this novelty of snow in Texas, but you do need to protect your skin. You need to make sure that you're getting breaks and getting warmed up, because you can really get hurt if you're out there too long.
Yeah, and it is not just Texas. As we said, neighboring Oklahoma, they've gone days now without getting above 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and even Seattle has gotten about a foot of snow. So how widespread is this system across the country?
Yeah, a couple of different storms are rotating through what's a bigger trough of low pressure across, say, the eastern two-thirds of the country, but then that trough also extends into the Pacific Northwest. So that's the storm pattern. Storms coming into the Pacific Northwest, diving very far south into, you know, central or even southern Texas, and then turning the corner, going through the Mid-South and eventually into the Northeast Corridor. So everybody along that path is seeing ice or snow. Anyone north of that path is in the extreme cold air. And yes, there is another storm waiting in the wings. So many of the same areas that we've been talking about are going to get snow again for the middle and end of the week, including North Texas. The Dallas area could see significant snow again. Little Rock could see significant snow. Memphis could see significant snow. I mean, these are areas that don't get snow every season. So to be talking about it twice in 1 week is just one more example of how incredible this weather pattern really is.
I mean, is it normal? I guess what you've been describing. No, it's not normal, actually. So what's causing it all to happen?
Yeah, so there's a loaded question, right? Because weather will always happen. And, you know, long-term averages are made up of weather extremes. And so it's winter. You're going to see winter weather. But you don't see this kind of winter weather every year. And a lot of people are like, oh, it's so cold. You said climate change and global warming. There is a, you know, ironic component to that, that as the poles warm at different levels, it messes with the polar vortex. I'm sure people have remember hearing about that from a couple years ago. As that slows down, that strong corridor of wind around the Arctic that keeps that cold air locked up, it gets all kinds of wiggly and wobbly. And that happens all the time. That polar vortex is always there. But this is an impressive wobble, if you will. So all that Arctic air spilled into the lower latitudes where the U.S. is, and that cold air is, you know, we're really feeling the impacts right now.
Mark Elliott at the Weather Channel, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
At the start of the pandemic, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was praised for his informative daily briefings. But a top aide told state lawmakers last week that the Cuomo administration was not as transparent as it seemed. The aide alleges the state held back data on the true extent of the death toll in nursing homes, and now lawmakers are calling for Cuomo to resign. For the latest, we're joined now by Sydney Pereira from member station WNYC. And Sydney, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So nearly 15,000 people have died in New York's nursing homes and long-term care facilities. What is the extent of what critics are calling a cover-up?
Well, these new higher fatality numbers that we are getting are coming on the heels of Attorney General Letitia James' findings that the fatalities may have been undercounted by 50%. So now we're seeing around 15,000 people in long-term care facilities, and that includes nursing homes and other adult care facilities who have died of COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. This aide that we're talking about, Melissa DeRosa, said in a phone call last week that the state did not report this data that you're talking about because it feared it would be subject to an investigation by the Justice Department under former President Trump. And they weren't sure whether this data would be used against them. Sydney, what exactly does she mean when she says used against them?
So she appeared to have been referring to a federal investigation by the Trump administration, and just based on what she had told lawmakers in that call, it seemed that she felt like it was the data was going to be politically used against the governor and Democrats in the state. And, you know, she's referencing how former President Donald Trump had been tweeting out against Democratic governors. Melissa DeRosa is right next to Governor Andrew Cuomo throughout the whole pandemic. She's his top aide and has been at these famous press briefings. When what she told state lawmakers came to light last week when the New York Post broke that story, she defended it as explaining that she and, you know, the governor and the state were focusing on the federal request for information to temporarily set aside the legislature's request and felt that that was the best way to handle the situation. But of course, now we're seeing with how she explained it privately to lawmakers, which is, you know, now in public, the state felt that because it had been politicized, it was okay to withhold the full scope of how many people had died. And I think what she, when she's saying used against them, she's really referring to being politically used against them.
Right. But the Justice Department wasn't the only ones asking for this data. New York State's legislature was also requesting it. And now there have been these calls for Governor Cuomo to step down. They're also talking about removing his emergency powers. What are lawmakers in both parties saying about this in the state?
Yeah. So Democratic lawmakers released a joint statement last Friday calling for the governor's expanded emergency powers to be removed. And then Republican lawmakers in the state are calling for Cuomo to resign altogether.
Mm-hmm. The entire country was watching Governor Cuomo during the early days of the pandemic. He's carefully cultivated his response to the pandemic with these daily briefings and really his very frank language and transparency. Has he responded at all to these allegations? How much of his reputation will be tarnished?
So he has not directly responded. There hasn't been a press briefing over the weekend, and he was in Washington, D.C. on Friday. And as for how much this tarnishes his reputation, I think it's kind of a long time coming. We knew the deaths in long-term care facilities were undercounted. We've long known that. We've known that since last spring. And so I think that now that we have the full picture, I don't think it looks great for him. But it's hard for me to say how much exactly it'll tarnish his reputation, because there were many points in the pandemic where Governor Cuomo was very much lauded for how he handled the pandemic. So it's hard to say how this will reach people, you know, and how many people will listen to reports like these and read about it to fully understand what exactly happened over the course of the past several months here.
That's Sydney Pereira with member station WNYC. Sydney, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you so much for having me.
The outcome didn't reflect this, but this weekend, we saw the most bipartisan impeachment vote in U.S. history. 7 Republican senators broke ranks, voting in favor, but it wasn't enough to convict former President Trump. The vote did, however, shed light on the growing split over what the Republican Party wants to be. And that split was evident Saturday in a lengthy speech by Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who said he voted not to convict because it would, quote, strain our own constitutional boundaries. But he also said this.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it.
McConnell's speech attempted to bridge a Trump-sized rift in the Republican Party. But the big question is, will it work? And for more, we're joined by Jane Mayer, a staff writer at The New Yorker, who has reported extensively on McConnell. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. So last month, in your New Yorker piece titled Why McConnell Dumped Trump, you wrote about how and why McConnell has distanced himself from Trump since the election. And you wrote, quote, nobody who has watched McConnell closely over the years views his split with Trump as a genuine moral reckoning. So with that, Jane, were you surprised at all that he voted to acquit the president?
No, I wasn't surprised that he voted to acquit the president. It seemed, even back a few weeks ago when I was writing about this, the sort of process argument that was raised by the lawyers about how it might be unconstitutional to impeach a president once he was out of office, that process argument would be the perfect fig leaf for those looking for an off-ramp who didn't want to have to directly confront the choice between convicting and acquitting former President Trump. And the thing, if you watch McConnell, he's always looking for a way to avoid unnecessary damaging positions. I think the key to understanding McConnell for anyone trying to watch this, and it is fascinating because he's very smart and incredibly powerful in Washington, probably the most powerful Republican in the party, in Congress for sure. But the key to understanding him is he's always looking for a way to win and how to keep his own power and the Republican Party's power. He's thinking about 2022. How do the Republicans get back in the majority in the Senate, and how can he stay at the helm of that? That's what's on his mind. So you have to understand that as you watch him.
I want to break that down a little bit more, because you also wrote this article back in April where you wrote, for months, I searched for the larger principles or sense of purpose that animates Mitch McConnell. And finally, someone who knows him very well told me, give up. You can't look and look for something more in him. It just isn't there. In the context of what that person said to you, does that mean possibly that we shouldn't hold that much weight in what he said on Saturday? Or you're saying we should look at it as sort of a blueprint in who he's talking to and why he's talking to them?
I think what that person was saying to me was that the only thing that Mitch McConnell really cares about is winning. getting in power and staying in power. There's not some kind of larger, you know, idealistic animating principle. If you study his whole career, as I did for months as I was trying to understand him, you can find that he's contradicted almost every single position he's held at some point or another. I mean, he just, you know, sort of swivels back and forth, doing whatever he needs to do to make sure that he wins at that moment. I mean, and there, you know, there are a few North Stars that, I mean, he's conservative, and that's for sure. But beyond that, the one thing, the only thing that's truly 100% consistent about him is that he has his eye on how to win. And he's not really shy about saying so. I mean, he gave an interview to Politico just over the weekend. He rarely does so, but he got on the phone with a reporter there, and he said, "For me, it's all about getting people elected, winning the elections." And he's looking again at 2022 and how to protect the members of the Republican senators in his caucus to not only get them reelected, but add one so the Republicans can get the majority.
Yeah, so it's a message to them. It's a message to Trump voters, to GOP donors. You mentioned that, you know, this also was sort of a fig leaf to not directly confront this choice to convict Trump. Seven Republican senators, though, did vote to convict the president, but only one of them, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, faces reelection in 2022. This really sets up the argument that so many of these Republicans saw this as a political calculation, right?
They did. And so the calculation for many of them was that they don't dare defy the Trump-loving base in their states. And so this is the dilemma that's so interesting watching this. There's obviously a split, as you call it, a Trump-sized split in the Republican Party between those endorsing him and those trying to sort of pull away. And he's been the power center, and the question is whether some other version of the Republican Party will emerge from this, and that's what McConnell's aiming at. He's spanning these two wings of the party, trying to keep them together, because he needs Trump voters in order to have his people reelected, but he also needs the money that comes from the big corporate donors who are very unhappy with the kind of violent extremism that we all saw on January 6th when Trump supporters stormed the Capitol. And so he's got to McConnell's trying to bridge that divide and have it both ways. He's saying nice things to the Republican moderates and donors by giving that, that very tough speech that was anti-Trump, yet he's voting to acquit Trump.
Right. More on your point there. Let's hear a little bit more from McConnell on Saturday. Here he is trying to separate the Capitol insurrection from the views of Republican voters. Let's listen.
Anyone who decries his awful behavior is accused of insulting millions of voters. That's an absurd deflection. 74 million Americans did not invade the Capitol. Hundreds of rioters did. 74 million Americans did not engineer the campaign of disinformation and rage that provoked it. One person did. Just one.
McConnell there is suggesting the people who invaded the Capitol were part of a fringe, not representative of most Trump voters. I mean, Jane, is that accurate? As long as Trump remains a leading figure in the Republican Party, I mean, many people are thinking, is there anything someone like McConnell can say or do to separate the legacy of the insurrection from the GOP?
Well, I mean, when you look closely at polls, there was one actually pretty interesting one from the American Enterprise Institute last week. It's a pretty conservative think tank. And they did a poll that shows that about a little bit over half of the Republican voters that they polled said they can imagine needing to use force to fight for their view of American politics. So you're looking at a pretty shockingly high percentage of Republican voters who are endorsing the idea of violent extremism potentially. It's a faction within the party that can't be overlooked, and it's not just Trump. I mean, first of all, it preceded Trump, and it will succeed Trump in some way or another. If it's something a strand that has to be contended with, and so what. Mm. Again, to return to McConnell, what he's trying to do is get maybe wound, damage, and maybe even banish Trump himself, but hold on to those Trump voters because he needs their votes. They need both sides of the Republican Party to win. They need the if they want to take control and power in this country, they've got to have the Trump base and they've got to have the corporate establishment Republicans. And right now, it's pretty hard to hold the two together, but that's what McConnell's trying to do.
Is what he's doing working, though? I mean, there is also this Gallup poll last month that found Americans' opinion of McConnell are the most negative they've ever been, largely because of this sharp drop in favorable ratings among Republicans overall. So is his strategy working? It seems like he's losing ground with the party's base.
Well, you know, the thing is, one of his strengths, as actually George Will writes in the Washington Post today, is McConnell's never really cared about being liked. He'd like to be feared, but he doesn't really seek approval that much of across the whole country. I'm sure, like everyone else, he'd like to be seen as a in a positive light. But that's not really what he's going for here. What he needs to win is a really small thing, in a way. He needs to win the support of the Republican caucus in the Senate so he can stay their leader. And that's why he didn't vote to acquit. If he had, he would have been like Liz Cheney, and he would have been they would have possibly turned against him. And he didn't. You know, he put himself first. He may think that Trump is a terrible threat to the country, but and if you listen to his words, he's saying that. But how did he vote? He voted to keep himself in power.
Jane Mayer, thank you so much for this conversation. We need another half hour to finish it, I tell you. It's Jane
Well, listen,
Mayer.
Thank you so much for delving into it. It is fascinating.
Yes. Jane Mayer, staff writer at The New Yorker.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from HomeTap, the smart way to access your home's equity and pay for life's expenses without a loan. With HomeTap, receive cash in as little as 3 weeks and use it for anything you'd like, from paying off debt to funding renovations and more. Plus, you don't have to deal with monthly payments or interest. Learn more about HomeTap and get a personalized estimate at HomeTap.com.
Decades before the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, Marcus Garvey attracted millions of followers with a message of Black self-sufficiency and Black nationalism in Africa.
For our Black History Month special series, The Seismic Influence and Complicated Legacy of Marcus Garvey.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
In Alaska, seal oil is an essential part of the Inupiat people's diets. It's high in omega-3 fatty acids and is often used with other traditional foods like salmon and caribou. But health regulations don't allow it to be bought in stores or served in restaurants. In Northwest Alaska, one group has become the first in the country cleared to make and serve its own seal oil. Wesley Early of Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
Like many Inupiat people in the Northwest Arctic, Cyrus Harris grew up eating traditional foods like caribou, muskox, and seal oil.
It's something that we've ate for centuries and centuries, from time immemorial, from way back.
Harris works at tribal health provider Manilik Association in the Inupiat community of Kotzebue. In 2014, Congress passed a farm bill which allowed people to donate wild game that they'd hunted to certified nonprofits like hospitals or food banks. Since then, Harris has been in charge of Manilik's Hunter Support Program. The program prepares traditional foods for elders at Manilik's Utakanat Inut long-term care facility. Walking in the freezer at the Sigalak, a state-certified meat processing building, Harris shows some of the donations.
These are some products that we will most likely use for our certain potlucks. This is sheepish fillet. And of course, we do have moose burger. We do have some muskox burger.
While getting wild meat on the menu for elders has gone smoothly for about 5 years, Harris says seal oil remained prohibited. Seal oil is generally ingested without incident, but has been linked to the foodborne illness botulism, which can cause nausea, blurry vision, and in some cases, death. Since the 1950s, the Manilik service area has seen more than 15 outbreaks of the illness tied to eating traditional native foods. In order to be certified to serve seal oil, Manilik had to find a process to remove the potential toxin. Harris says the process for rendering seal oil starts with separating the skin and blubber from the carcass.
Then flush the blubber from the skin and then cut into maybe 1-inch by 3-inch pieces, you know, and set into containers like this.
He points to 3 large drums in the processing room with strips of blubber floating in seal oil. In order to rid it of the botulism risk, a new step had to be added.
We wanted to keep it as close to the traditional process as possible, but then, you know, a slight modification to that process to control for that botulism.
Chris Dankmeyer is environmental health manager for Manilik. For the past few years, he, Harris, and others have been collaborating to develop a way to safely render seal oil. After several years of running lab tests, they found that heating the seal oil to 176 degrees for 10 continuous minutes made seal oil safe.
That completely destroys the toxin that may or may not be in the oil.
After the pure seal oil is heat treated and then rapidly cooled to prevent the toxin from reforming, the oil will be placed in the freezer until it's time to be served. In January, after reviewing Manilik's heat treatment process, the state of Alaska officially granted the healthcare provider an exemption from the law prohibiting the serving of seal oil. One person excited to see the reaction from elders is Marcella Wilson, who runs Utakanit Inut. She says the elders' spirits are always lifted whenever they're served their traditional foods.
I'm not saying that there's magic in it, because there's not, but there is such a nutritional value to it and such a cultural value to it, so the two together are just immeasurable.
Wilson says that she's learned a lot about the Inupiaq culture from the elders, and she expects them to feel more lively with seal oil on the menu. For Here and Now, I'm Wesley Early in Kotzebue.
There is something about Selena that has captured the hearts and minds of generations. The Tejana pop superstar's life was cut short in 1995. But for passing admirers, and in particular her Latinx and Chicana fans, she's a mirror and a guide to what's possible, to what it means to belong on both sides of the U.S. and Mexico border.
To see someone like me making it on her own terms, one of ours, those of us in the middle who felt like we weren't enough to be fully Mexican or fully American. But Selena was enough in both places. And that meant that maybe I could be enough.
That's Maria Garcia. She's WBUR Senior Arts and Culture Editor and the host and producer of Anything for Selena, a new podcast unpacking not only the life of the singer, but the way Selena has impacted us all. And Maria Garcia joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tanya. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. So this entire podcast is really a slowing down of what makes Selena's legacy so enduring. You spend a year examining and unpacking her impact on the world, which really can't be separated from you, Maria, as a Mexican-American. When you started this project, did you know going in that you'd have to get so personal to really tell the story of her impact?
No, not this personal. I knew that I could not tell Selena's story from just any place in the world. I knew that I had to tell Selena's story from the place in the world that I occupy, from my lens. That is a lens of a fronteriza, of somebody who grew up on the U.S.-Mexico border. Because the reason
I knew Selena mattered so much is because I experienced it. I experienced what it felt like to see a woman who didn't have to code switch on either side of the border, who celebrated an identity that had felt so derided for so long. I was not expecting how vulnerable it would get and what a reckoning it would be for me on so many levels.
And we're going to get to that personal reckoning in just a moment. But first, this podcast through you really gives us a deeper understanding of the perceptions of Latinos in this country. There's a part in your podcast where you play a clip from Howard Stern's show just a few days after Selena was killed. And here Stern is reacting to a Tejano DJ who confronted him about how insensitive it was for Stern to play gunshot sounds when talking about Selena. Let's listen.
Okay, and so you did do it. And I'm going to do it again. Okay. And I'm going to do it 20 friggin' times. Right, and I want you to leave my country.
No, man.
Leave my country.
I was born in this country, homeboy. I have the same equal rights you do, carnal.
All we talked about was the music and how goofy the Spanish music is. And if you're not...
If you can't say that, then it ain't America.
Yeah, then go to Mexico if you don't like it.
Maria, why was it important to include this clip?
Well, because it happened at a very crucial moment in culture. This happened the Monday after Selena died. She died on that Friday. So the days leading up to this, all we had seen on national television were images of these distraught Latinos, working class Latinos, people who were often not made visible. And so everything felt really raw. And then, you know, Monday rolls around and Howard Stern and his producers make it a point to make fun of the mourners and to make fun of Selena and then to make fun of Mexicans in general. You know, I know Howard Stern has made fun of other people like this, but it was important for me to include that because that shows us that mourning Selena, loving Selena has always been political. That was sort of the weekend that her symbol very clearly sort of concretized as sort of a shorthand for Latino identity in this country.
You also take us back to the 90s and the late 90s in particular in other ways. For instance, when Jennifer Lopez starred as Selena in the movie, and that was the start of what we now call the Latin boom with the rise of Ricky Martin and Shakira And you do this to lay bare the complicated and racial politics of what it means to be Latino, specifically with what you call big butt politics. How do we go from Selena to a conversation about the whitewashing of big butts in our culture?
Because I saw it in my lifetime, Tanya. I mean, when I was a kid, like in my community, a big butt was like something that was praised and normal. Yeah. You know, and Black women have always been at the head of celebrating butts and big butt culture. And this episode really digs into how Latinas historically in pop culture have taken something that has been derided in Black women and have made it accessible and desirable and safe for white audiences and have capitalized on Black culture. And so it opens this bigger conversation about Latinidad often being used as a tool of white supremacy. Mm. And I mean, I don't want to get too intellectual, but really, I mean, I think it's a reckoning about, like, when we say Latinidad, when we say like this idea of Latino identity, well, who was it made for and who was it not made for?
I want to play a clip, actually, where you sum this up on that episode specifically of the podcast.
So the butt, to me, is a story about a reckoning, about Latinidad coming to terms with how it was built, how it has been defined through Selena and J-Lo and the Latin boom, as though it was an identity for all of us, but it never was. And maybe it's time we confront that.
Maria, what would confronting anti-Blackness within the Latino community or representation of Latinidad look like?
There's not a finish line. There's not saying, oh, if we were to only accomplish this, it's an orientation. But for me, for example, Tanya,
one of the next episodes that we have coming up is an episode where we dig deeper into the relationship of anti-Blackness and colonization and how we see it in our own families. And, you know, I was looking through family pictures and I was like, my grandmother, if I were to see her in the U.S., like, she would be legible to me as a Black woman, or at least like a mixed race woman, like Indigenous and Black. And yet we never acknowledged her Blackness. And I was talking to my aunt and I said, why didn't my grandmother grow out her hair ever? And she said, oh, because if she did, she'd have an Afro. It was sort of this reckoning, right? That this erasure of Blackness generationally has been happening in my family for a long time. And at the same time that I was coming to terms with this family history, I was also confronting my own whiteness and thinking about the way I navigate the world, because I had to think about these memories that I have of my grandmother and I, and these stories that I would hear about how much she praised my fair skin when I was born. And I've had to ask myself, what does it mean that my life source, my grandmother, you know, because geneticists say that like your grandmother, your maternal grandmother is the key to generational trauma, to the joys that are passed down generation to generation. What does it mean that I came from a woman whose Blackness was erased, you know, and that I now, you know, even though I'm legible in places like Boston, like a woman of color, you know, I started thinking about my skin. And I think as Latinos, we have to have a deeper conversation about whiteness.
Maria Garcia, the host and producer of Anything for Selena, available wherever you get your podcasts. Maria, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Tania. Thank you so much.
The number of coronavirus cases in the U.S. has fallen in the past month, and the number of people getting vaccinated every day is going up. So that's good news. But at this rate, the country is still on pace for another 80,000 COVID-19 deaths every month, which is why The Atlantic's Derek Thompson says it's crucial to take some potentially controversial steps to save lives and get the pandemic under control by the summer. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Sure. So people may be thinking, actually, that things are already getting under control because the number of infections has dropped 60% in the past month, and that's pretty good. But what is going on?
It's really good. And it's not entirely clear that we have like 100% understanding of what's going on. But let me give you three possible variables that might explain the really, really sharp drop, not only in cases, but also more importantly, in hospitalizations. Number one is weather. Seasonality. I was just looking at an October 2020 report on coronaviruses around the world that found that they typically peak in the Northern Hemisphere during the winter, with the most common peak being in January and February. So it might just be in the nature of this type of virus to accelerate through the winter and peak around the turn of the year. Number two, there's immunity. Tens of millions of Americans have already had COVID, and it's possible that so many Americans have already been infected that we have a bank of immunity such that the decline from that peak has really been accelerated by the fact that there's just a lot of people who are protected against this disease by virtue of the fact that they've already been infected. Number three, there's behavior. I really do think that in the last few months, especially after the holidays, Americans have gotten more comfortable with wearing masks. And there is a little bit of evidence to suggest that their behavior, their mobility, has become more risk averse in the last few weeks. And that might also be accelerating the decline in cases and this decline in hospitalizations.
Interesting. Now, Derek, I was wondering if it had anything to do with the fact that we are getting more people vaccinated than ever before. Now, 1.6 million people a day on average are getting shots.
This is probably a part of it for sure. But 2 points on that. Number one, we saw this decline in cases and this really sharp decline in hospitalizations start before the acceleration in vaccinations. So vaccines can't explain the entire drop. But it's absolutely the case that, look, almost 10%, about 10% of Americans have received at least one shot of vaccine, according to numbers that I just looked at. You add that, say, 10% of Americans with one shot of vaccine to maybe 20, 30% of Americans who have already had COVID and now have immunity. You add that up and you're at maybe 35, 40% of the country that has some level of immunity to this disease. Mm. And that may be a part of the picture that we're seeing, that it's not just seasonality, which is a natural component of this virus, but it's being accentuated by the fact that there is just a bank of immunity in this country.
Okay, so all of that is great, but I want to be very clear. We are not out of this yet. Some states are starting to lift restrictions, and that has public health officials very concerned. You write in your recent Atlantic article, you actually lay out a few ideas that could help us get a handle on this pandemic even quicker. Number one, you say, authorize more vaccines. Tell me more about that.
Sure. I think right now we have a supply issue. There are way more people who want vaccines than there are vaccines available. And I think that there are various ways that we can stretch that supply. I talked to epidemiologists, vaccinologists, who said we should approve the AstraZeneca vaccine. It has been shown to be quite effective, especially for younger people. We can use it now, and even though it can't be or maybe shouldn't be used for people older than 45, 50, well, that just means that there's more of the mRNA vaccines from Pfizer, Moderna that we could use for that older population. Another thing that we could do is run experiments with the supply that we have. There is one idea called First Doses First, which is an idea that essentially says we should stretch our supply by giving as many people as possible first shots of the vaccine rather than giving first and second shots with the current amount of doses that we have right now. Still, other people think that we should be running NIH tests where we experiment with partial dosing. So giving people, say, 2/3 of a dose of a vaccine, mm-hmm. because that has been shown actually to have really solid immunity, or really solid protectiveness. So I think that, you know, the people that I talked to essentially said, any way that we can accelerate, and I've been using that word a lot, but it's so important, thousands of people are dying a day. Any way that we can accelerate our use of vaccines will save thousands and thousands of lives. And so we should be open to having a scientific approach toward extending the supply of vaccines that we have.
Now, we should have a decision, hopefully, maybe by the end of the month on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
That's
AstraZeneca
right.
is another story. We've seen that the data show that it's not particularly effective against the South African variant, so that would be one thing to consider. Now, just quickly, Derek, you also looked at eligibility, which right now varies from state to state. You're saying this should be simplified, and quickly, please.
Oh, sure. I mean, Washington State right now is in phase 1B tier 1. That was after phase 1A tier 2 and phase 1A tier 1. These 1B, 1C guidelines, I think, are too fussy. They're too confusing. They're very difficult to operationalize. Simpler is better, and having a larger supply of vaccines allows us to open things up and be simpler as well.
Derek Thompson, thank you so much. Here and Now is a production of NPR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.